Nemoto presents addiction. Make the map do the work from pilot to policy. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Ava voice. Running time, approximately 29 minutes. Addiction is a human condition expressed through specific lives, neighborhoods, markets, and institutions. Drugs, devices, and behaviors are vehicles. The underlying pattern is the same. Relief is discovered. Repetition trains attention and routine, alternatives atrophy, and necessity replaces choice. A serious response accepts that pattern and arranges systems accordingly. The aim is simple to state and demanding to execute. Fewer preventable deaths, fewer preventable infections, more stable housing, more days of work or school, more reunified families and public spaces that are safe because neighbors can use them without stepping around crisis. A community that reaches those outcomes is not idealized. It is organized. A practical blueprint begins with a clear baseline. A county or city assembles an inventory of clinics, hospital services, pharmacies, outreach teams, syringe and naloxone programs, mobile vans, housing units with and without sobriety requirements, shelters, recovery housing, diversion programs, peer networks, employer partnerships, apprenticeship slots, transportation routes, and court practices. This inventory is not a report for a shelf. It is a working map updated weekly. Data systems that cannot speak to one another are connected through consented sharing and standard formats so that emergency calls, overdose reversals, hospital admissions, clinic intakes, housing placements, and release schedules can be seen together. The baseline reveals gaps, hours that do not match need, corridors without services, bottlenecks at intake, long waits for medications, and neighborhoods where deaths cluster while resources are thin. Early action focuses on what prevents death immediately and what makes first contact successful. Clinics provide same-day starts for medications used in opioid and alcohol use disorders, with protocols for co-use of benzodiazepines and stimulants. Outreach teams saturate high-risk zones with naloxone and train bystanders in recognition of respiratory depression and rescue breathing. Public communications replace slogans with addresses, hours, and clear directions for access. Hospitals treat infections fully and hand patients directly to named clinic staff with transportation and bridge prescriptions. Jails and prisons initiate or continue medications and arrange release day handoffs that include identification documents, insurance activation, an appointment at a precise time, transit passes, and phones linked to clinics. Librarians, transit staff, shelter workers, and security guards are trained to recognize overdose, retrieve naloxone, and contact emergency services without delay. These steps are not dramatic. They are decisive. Retention becomes the next measure. Surviving the first week means little if engagement collapses in the first month. Appointment times align with dosing schedules, shift work, and caregiving. Text reminders, brief check-ins, and transportation vouchers reduce friction. Co-located services reduce drop-off between referrals. Contingency management delivers immediate reinforcement for attendance, negative toxicology for a target substance, and completion of milestones. The reinforcement is modest, certain, and transparent. Programs protect access to medications. Zero-tolerance rules that expel participants for lapses are replaced with structured responses that adjust dose, increase contact, and solve practical problems. Case managers have manageable caseloads and the authority to handle deposits, utility arrears, identification fees, and document replacement so that minor obstacles do not become relapses. Housing policy is treated as clinical infrastructure. A person without a door that locks cannot store medication securely, schedule telehealth privately, or sleep predictably. Housing first units reduce mortality and emergency utilization even before abstinence. Recovery housing helps others who prefer substance-free environments. Oversight prevents exploitation and aligns rules with evidence rather than ideology. Landlord engagement teams reduce evictions by substituting supervision and support for sudden removal after a lapse. Lease preservation protocols become standard. When noise, guests, or missed rent threaten stability, a rapid response team intervenes before the situation spirals. Housing authorities adopt fair chance policies that consider rehabilitation evidence rather than blanket exclusions for old convictions. Employment converts stabilization into momentum. Supported employment places participants quickly in competitive jobs with coaching that follows into the workplace. Apprenticeships recruit from clinics and housing, offering paid training, predictable schedules, mentorship, and wage growth. Sectors suited to this approach include building trades, clean energy, healthcare support roles, logistics, advanced manufacturing, and municipal maintenance. Employers adopt policies that treat substance use disorders as health conditions. Confidential disclosure routes, medical leave for stabilization, medications protected under standard procedures, and structured return-to-work plans that specify temporary duty modifications and supervisor communication. Benefit cliffs are mapped in advance so that a wage increase does not produce a net income loss. Temporary supplements, phased benefit reductions, or earnings disregards smooth the transition. Justice systems align with health rather than substitute for it. Patrol officers deflect eligible cases of possession or public intoxication to services at the scene or within hours. Prosecutors expand a version that emphasizes rapid treatment entry, acceptance of indicated medications, and measure responses to setbacks. Courts calibrate sanctions and protect access to medications. Automatic incarceration for a missed appointment is replaced with brief, certain responses, and renewed linkage. Inside facilities, withdrawal is managed safely, medications are initiated or continued, and infectious diseases are treated. 30 days before release, a plan is executed. Identification documents are secured, insurance is activated, appointments are scheduled, transportation is arranged, a phone is provided, naloxone is placed in hand, and a named person from the receiving clinic meets the individual at the gate or the bus. Primary care assumes its role as the stable platform. Screening is universal, brief, and non-judgmental. Prescription monitoring data are visible inside the prescribing workflow. High-risk combinations are flagged. Pain management relies on multimodal strategies with functional goals rather than on long-term high-dose regimens by default. Depression, anxiety, attention deficit syndromes, and trauma are treated in the same clinics that manage addiction, with psychopharmacology aligned to stages of change and psychotherapy timed to capacity. Vaccination, hepatitis C treatment, HIV care, wound care, and dental care are integrated rather than serially referred. Electronic records automate reminders, track retention, and support continuity across settings. Hospitals adapt protocols to reduce avoidable harm. Emergency departments start medications after overdose reversal or during withdrawal and hand patients to clinics the same day. Inpatient teams conduct addiction consultations for endocarditis, osteomyelitis, cellulitis, pancreatitis, gastrointestinal bleeding, and complicated alcohol withdrawal, initiating or adjusting medications and coordinating outpatient continuation. Perioperative planning maintains buprenorphine or methadone rather than interrupting, adds regional anesthesia where appropriate, and uses clear communication to avoid contradictory instructions. Discharge practices include prescriptions, naloxone, wound care supplies, and appointments arranged at specific times, not vague referrals to call a number. Women's health and perinatal systems use non-punitive pathways that protect infant health and maternal stability. Prenatal clinics provide confidential screening, same-day initiation of indicated medications, and integrated care for depression, anxiety, trauma, and intimate partner violence. Labor and delivery centers provide pain management without undermining maintenance therapies. Neonatal care prioritizes rooming in, skin-to-skin contact, quiet environments, and standardized pharmacologic protocols when needed. Postpartum plans extend insurance coverage where policy permits, schedule early follow UPS, align pediatric and maternal visits, and include home visiting supports. Child welfare agencies distinguish between unmanaged risk and managed treatment, preferring family preservation with plans of safe care when safety can be maintained. Adolescents and emerging adults receive developmentally appropriate care that protects confidentiality and builds practical skills. School-based services embed screening and brief interventions. Campus policies include Good Samaritan protections and walk-in access to clinical care. Messaging addresses counterfeit pill risk directly, with clear instructions on emergency response. Family engagement focuses on de-escalation, safe storage, disposal of unused prescriptions, and consistent boundaries. Housing options for youth include shelters and transitional units that do not require abstinence as a condition of entry, paired with schooling and employment pathways. After hospitalization or detention, bridge prescriptions, transportation, and scheduled appointments prevent early loss to follow-up. Stimulant patterns are addressed without spectacle. Programs plan for psychosis management, sleep rehabilitation, nutrition, cardiovascular screening, and contingency management. Where fentanyl contaminates supplies, naloxone distribution remains essential. Safer smoking supplies reduce injury, drug checking deeters use when danger is confirmed, and informs alerts when composition changes. Clinics coordinate management of alcohol and benzodiazepines that often accompany stimulants, and they design slow tapers with sleep interventions when dependence on sedatives is present. Outreach teams carry water, electrolyte solutions, snacks, wound care, naloxone, and information about shelters and clinics, and they keep predictable schedules. Measurement governs everything that follows. Dashboards display access to first appointments, time to first dose, retention at 30, 90, and 180 days, all-cause mortality, overdose reversals, emergency department utilization, inpatient admissions and readmissions, hepatitis and HIV testing and treatment, vaccination rates, wound care episodes, housing stability, employment and school attendance, family reunification, and patient-reported quality of life. Data are disaggregated by age, gender, race, language, and geography to reveal inequities. Risk adjustment protects clinics serving higher acuity populations. Dashboards update on a schedule that staff and residents can learn. Numbers guide budgets. Programs that deliver improvements expand. Programs that cannot correct course wind down. Financing aligns with outcomes. Fee-for-service medicine rarely pays for outreach, care coordination, peer work, housing navigation, transportation, or childcare. Blended arrangements combine health dollars with workforce, housing, and justice funds. Value-based contracts tie a portion of payment to retention, mortality reduction, infection control, housing stability, and employment, with risk adjustment to prevent cherry-picking. Public payers cover medications for opioid and alcohol use disorders without burdensome prior authorization. Settlement funds invest in job developer teams embedded in clinics, apprenticeship cohorts, childcare capacity, employer training on fair chance policies, union-backed mentorship, housing stock, and the data infrastructure required to run the system as designed. Technology reduces friction when used with discipline. Telemedicine extends reach to rural regions and to individuals balancing work, caregiving, and mobility limits. Electronic records embed decision support at points of care, display prescription monitoring data without separate logins, and automate follow-up reminders. Secure messaging between clinics, pharmacies, supervision officers, housing teams, and employment specialists solves small problems before they end plans. Wastewater analysis and spectrometry at drug checking sites provide early signals about supply changes. Overdose detection devices and alert apps provide safety nets for people who insist on using alone. Data governance protects privacy with consented sharing and minimal access necessary to act. Technology that becomes surveillance drives participants away. Technology that reduces steps increases engagement. Equity is designed rather than hoped for. Clinic locations follow need, not convenience. Hours match bus schedules and work patterns. Language access is built into every touchpoint. Staff are hired from the communities served. Transportation vouchers, mobile services, and evening and weekend hours reduce structural barriers. Equity reviews occur on a schedule and trigger visible corrections when data show disparities in access, dosing, sanction rates, housing loss, or outcomes. Without deliberate design, unequal systems continue to produce unequal results. Workforce policy recognizes that quality and capacity depend on people who are trained, supported, and paid on time. Clinicians learn addiction pharmacotherapy, trauma-informed practice, and culturally responsive care. Peers receive certification, supervision, career ladders, and wages that reduce turnover. Case managers have caseloads that permit meaningful contact. Outreach workers have field safety protocols, debriefing structures, and protective equipment. Supervisors are trained to coach rather than to escalate. Burnout prevention is routine. Predictable schedules, coverage for illness, access to mental health support, and recognition for steady performance. Programs that rely on goodwill alone churn staff and lose experience. Programs that budget for people retain skill and deliver stability. Risk management is routine rather than heroic. Fentanyl spikes or the introduction of new sedatives prompt Puritan protocols, increased oxygen availability, training refreshers on respiratory support, additional outreach shifts, targeted alerts, and modified induction strategies to reduce precipitated withdrawal. Heat waves lead to cooling stations, adjust to outreach hours, and hydration supplies. Cold snaps lead to additional shelter capacity, expanded van hours, and partnerships with libraries and transit hubs. Outbreaks of hepatitis or syphilis trigger rapid testing and treatment drives. Each scenario has a playbook. Rehearsals occur before crises. Communication replaces spectacle with service. Announcements include addresses, hours, bus routes, and phone numbers answered by trained staff. Alerts about dangerous batches describe signs to watch for and steps that reduce harm. Reports include successes and gaps. Media coverage avoids images and phrases that harden stigma and highlights programs that show measurable gains. Deaths down, retention up, infections treated, housing stabilized, apprentices completing, reunifications finalized. Public trust follows visible competence, not slogans. Governance keeps attention honest. An interagency board, health, housing, justice, education, labor, employers, unions, philanthropy, and community organizations, meets on a schedule, publishes minutes, and maintains dashboards. When metrics worsen, the board assigns responsibility and a deadline for correction. Budgets move accordingly. Policies change when data demand it. Leaders model clarity and humility, acknowledge trade-offs, and avoid reinventing the wheel when tested practices exist. Governance resists drift back to theater by insisting on visible routines and by treating exceptions as temporary rather than as new norms. The blueprint must adapt to rural and urban realities. Rural regions rely on hub-and-spoke designs that connect specialty hubs to community clinics, pharmacies, and mobile teams. Pharmacies become critical access points for medications and naloxone. Telemedicine and loan forgiveness programs recruit clinicians. Urban regions coordinate among hospitals, shelters, libraries, transit hubs, and neighborhood organizations, using density to specialize and to locate services near where people live and work. In both contexts, outreach schedules are published and reliable. In both, procurement rules allow for oxygen, naloxone, wound care supplies, and drug checking equipment where lawful. In both, training occurs across sectors so that staff in non-clinical roles know what to do when a medical emergency appears in their workplace. Prevention is embedded across development rather than staged as occasional campaigns. Early childhood programs support caregiver mental health and treat parental substance use. Schools teach emotion regulation, media literacy, sleep hygiene, and peer influence navigation. Universities and trade schools instruct students in bystander skills for overdose, sexual assault prevention, and mental health crises, and provide walk-in access to care. Employers include addiction education in supervisor training and stock naloxone in first aid kits. Families receive scripts for calm conversations, boundary setting, and emergency response, along with storage devices for medications and instructions for safe disposal of unused prescriptions. Prevention succeeds when it teaches skills, provides tools, and builds routines. Ethics and rights remain central. Consent processes are comprehensible and documented. Privacy protections are respected while enabling coordinated action through appropriate consents. Withholding medications as punishment is recognized as unsafe and counterproductive. Involuntary holds are reserved for imminent danger and are paired with rapid transition to voluntary care. Pregnant patients receive non-punitive pathways that protect infant health and maternal stability. Older adults are screened for polypharmacy and fall risk with careful deprescribing where appropriate. People with disabilities receive accommodations that make engagement possible. These are not extras. They are the conditions under which serious work can occur. The culture of institutions changes as routines settle. Staff stop treating relapse as betrayal and start treating it as a signal to adjust care. Participants stop treating help as a trap and start treating it as a resource. Employers stop treating disclosure as disqualifying and start treating it as an opportunity to retain trained staff with structured support. Courts stop measuring success by the length of a sentence and start measuring by housing stability, employment, and family preservation. Police stop judging performance by possession arrests and start judging by reductions in violence and overdose deaths. Hospitals stop discharging with vague referrals and start handing patients to named clinicians in the community. Each change reinforces the next. The result is not perfection. It is reliability. Common failure modes are avoided by design. Pilot projects do not remain pilots when they perform, they scale. Gatekeeping that adds steps without improving safety is removed. Security theater, rules that create the appearance of control while eroding engagement, is replaced with controls that measurably reduce risk. Zero tolerance policies that drive problems underground give way to contingency plans that protect participants and the public. Funding cycles do not end programs abruptly. Bridges are planned and executed. Staff departures do not collapse services because cross-training and documentation are standard. Sustainability depends on aligning incentives with the outcomes a community claims to want. Contracts reward retention and functional gains rather than throughput. Harm reduction programs receive stable funding in recognition of lives saved and infections prevented. Housing initiatives are financed with rent supports and case management together. Employer partnerships are supported by tax credits, coaching, and recognition. Data teams are staffed to turn numbers into operational decisions. Public dashboards allow residents to see progress and to ask fair questions when numbers stall. Year by year, the system becomes less dependent on heroics and more defined by the kind of competence that leaves few headlines because crises occur less often. This blueprint remains anchored to the central premise. Addiction is a human condition. The subject concerns people under pressure, not substances in isolation. Systems that acknowledge that premise design for survival first, stability second, and flourishing third. Survival requires oxygen, naloxone, medications, cooling centers, shelter beds, and staff who can respond without hesitation. Stability requires routines, housing, employment, childcare, transport, and predictable clinics. Flourishing requires roles in families, workplaces, schools, and communities. Each layer depends on the previous one being in place long enough to matter. A final step looks at budgets through the same lens. Dollars allocated to enforcement against violent trafficking and corruption address real threats and should be maintained. Dollars that chase possession for personal use without providing treatment, housing, or employment pathways are repurposed. Health dollars fund outreach, care coordination, and medications. Housing dollars build stock and preserve leases. Workforce dollars fund job development and apprenticeships. Education dollars fund skills that reduce vulnerability. Settlement dollars fund infrastructure that survives grant cycles. The redistribution is not symbolic. It is reflected in line items visible to residents and in outcomes that can be measured quarterly. The community that adopts this approach will still have people in pain, conflicts to resolve, and days that go badly. The difference is that the system meets those moments with plans that already exist. A grandmother does not wait hours in an emergency department corridor after an overdose reversal because a clinic starts medication that day and hands her to a named person. A young worker does not lose a job after a lapse because a supervisor follows a return-to-work plan rather than rumor. A parent does not avoid prenatal care because disclosure would lead to punishment. The clinic offers help without threat and coordinates a plan of safe care. A person released at dawn with a small bag does not wander. Transportation is waiting, and the first appointment is kept. A library staff member does not panic when a patron slumps. Naloxone is used and breathing resumes. None of these scenes are theatrical. They are ordinary competence applied to a serious subject. Over time, metrics move. Deaths fall. Infections decline. Shelter stays shorten. Housing stability rises. Emergency departments record fewer repeat visits from the same addresses. Employers report higher retention and lower injury rates. Schools note improved attendance and graduation. Family court caseloads shift from termination to reunification. Neighborhoods feel safer because residents use public spaces. The story told in public meetings changes from accusation and blame to review and improvement. The question shifts from who is at fault to which step failed and how will it be repaired by Friday. The last implication concerns memory. Many jurisdictions have spent years prosecuting a war against drugs and have a long archive of press conferences to show for it. The archive that matters now is a different one. Appointment logs that show same-day starts, payroll data that show steady hours, housing records that show leases preserved, court records that show diversion completed, clinic dashboards that show retention, EMS records that show reversals, and hospital data that show infections treated. The memory of competence becomes cultural capital. It teaches new staff how to behave, reduces turnover, and anchors public trust. Addiction will remain because pain and appetite will remain. The task is to reduce unnecessary suffering and prevent avoidable death while building ordinary days that do not revolve around a substance. The method is clear. Measure what matters, fund what works, design for speed and dignity, protect medications, embed housing and employment, align justice with health, and keep routines visible. The insistence on ordinary competence may feel unambitious in a culture trained to seek dramatic gestures. It is the only approach with a track record of durable gains. This episode closes the initial series with a simple statement. A county or city that treats addiction as a human condition organizes clinics, hospitals, housing, employers, schools, courts, and data around that truth. The work is repetitive and rarely cinematic. It is also the work that produces fewer funerals, more paychecks, more reunified families, and public spaces that feel like places to live rather than to avoid. That is a serious objective. The plan described here is the direct route toward it.